to Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Wyatt here again to have another conversation with you about some of the stories that matter. Folks, we want to start off today's show going straight to Governor Hogan, who called for a COVID-19 presser with immediate updates on what's happening in Maryland. I'm as interested in what's going to happen as you are. Let's take a listen to the governor.
Since the beginning of this new COVID-19 surge, we have taken a series of aggressive actions to save lives, keep our hospitals from overflowing, and to keep as many Marylanders as employed as we can. Recent actions include issuing a public health advisory to limit all gatherings, limiting occupancy at retail establishments, bars, and restaurants, and requiring them to close at 10 o'clock p.m. We expanded our out-of-state travel advisory, strictly limited hospital visitation. Again, we expanded hospital surge capacity and our alternate care site capacity. We activated a critical coordination center to transfer patients between hospitals. We mobilized an unprecedented medical staffing surge. We restricted visitation to nursing homes and expanded testing for residents and staff. We doubled the number of rapid response teams to assist with outbreaks. We provided additional assistance for food banks, foster care, and tenants. And we built an entire operation to deliver and distribute COVID-19 vaccines, which are on the way. We are continuing to constantly monitor all of the data, the metrics, and the modeling in order to determine what additional statewide mitigation actions may be required. While here in Maryland, we continue to take constant actions on a daily basis to fight this virus from all directions, Congress continues to fail at the one simple thing we have been asking them to do for the last 8 months, which is to provide additional emergency relief for our struggling families and small businesses. Earlier this week, I spoke with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, along with numerous leaders in the Senate, about the ongoing negotiations in Congress over COVID-19 relief. We continue to stress to all of our leaders in Washington on both sides of the aisle the urgent need for them to reach a consensus on a relief package, even if it's only on a temporary Band-Aid approach that lasts for a few months. Something is better than nothing. Here in Maryland, we announced $500 million in state emergency economic relief. More than $215 million has now been provided through our COVID-19 Emergency Relief Fund to more than 16,000 businesses across the state. $50 million has been distributed to all 24 jurisdictions for our restaurant relief fund to support both indoor and outdoor dining. More than $40 million has been directed through the Maryland Nonprofit Recovery Initiative to more than 1,800 nonprofit organizations across the state. Nearly $25 million has been awarded through our Layoff Aversion Fund to more than 1,000 small businesses from all 24 jurisdictions, saving another 20,000 Maryland jobs. We are directing more than $8 million to entities that rely heavily on tourism and visitors, including museums, zoos, aquariums, and cultural attractions. Nearly $5 million have been provided through our Maryland Farmer COVID Relief Program to more than 1,300 Maryland farm families. While we continue to wait for Congress to finally get its act together, today we are taking a series of additional state actions to help businesses struggling to hang on, to avoid the prospect of more layoffs, and to try to keep some businesses from going out of business. During this crisis, our small businesses have had to make very difficult decisions to move ahead with layoffs and furloughs, despite their best efforts. As a result, many businesses are scheduled to face massive automatic increases in the unemployment taxes they will be forced to pay through no fault of their own. This is yet another blow for businesses already suffering tremendous losses. Today, I have signed an executive order to protect Maryland businesses from sudden or substantial increases in their unemployment taxes. This emergency relief will help more businesses keep their operations going and to help keep more people on their payrolls. In March, as part of our first round of state economic relief, we provided $75 million in emergency loans to Maryland small businesses. Today, I have directed the Department of Commerce to take immediate action to forgive the entire $75 million in emergency small business debt. These loans will be converted to grants, which will not have to be paid back. This will provide additional, much-needed relief to many of those small businesses so that they can stay in business and keep their employees on their payrolls. We're also announcing a major investment in affordable housing. We will be funding another $25 million in low-income housing tax credit projects, which will approve and promote the construction of 2,000 units of high-quality affordable housing, and which will create even more jobs. This is the largest number of units the state has ever financed in a single year. Today, we are also releasing $12 million through the Rental Housing Works program, which will spur even more projects and create even more jobs for construction workers and related industries across the state. In addition to these aggressive relief actions by the state, we are urging county governments to match the relief dollars that we have provided at the state level. And again, we are encouraging them to push out every single penny of their remaining CARES Act funding out into our economy and into the hands of the people who desperately need it in the next few weeks before it runs out at the end of this year. Today, we are also making additional new investments to address the health and well-being of Marylanders. We are committing $94 million in new grants and investments to help treat Marylanders with diabetes during the COVID-19 pandemic. More than one out of every three Marylanders either has diabetes or pre-diabetes, which puts them at a much greater risk and is the number one comorbidity for people getting serious illness from COVID-19. With these investments, hospitals and their community health partners will be able to launch comprehensive community-based prevention and treatment initiatives, and Care First will work with local health improvement coalitions to combat social and health disparities for people who have diabetes or who are at higher risk for diabetes. Today, we are committing another $10 million in investments to support a wide range of initiatives for law enforcement, youth services, and victim services, including a new COVID-19 Safe Futures Collaborative that connects crime victims to accessing the critical services that they need virtually. In addition to funding for PPE and protective barriers for the 34 district court locations across the state, rapid testing equipment and supplies for the Maryland State Police, as well as additional resources to increase internet access in Baltimore City for vulnerable children and youth. Tonight marks the beginning of Hanukkah, and I want to wish all of those celebrating a happy Festival of Lights. For each and every one of us this year, the holidays need to be a season of increased vigilance. Our hospitals are nearing capacity.
So welcome back to Today with Dr. K. That was Governor Larry Hogan reminding us of his plans to help the city. What's interesting is I feel like we just had a presser from the government, and I felt like we just got the same information. So let's kind of state again what Governor Hogan has done. And then I want to go back to what Mayor Brandon Scott is doing as of Friday, because I want to know whether or not you agree with how the mayor came out the gate, y'all. So according to Governor Hogan, more than $215 million of Maryland's $500 million economic relief has now been provided through COVID-19 Emergency Relief Fund. It's been sent out to more than 16,000 businesses across the state. Today, we are immediately taking additional state actions to help struggling businesses to avoid layoffs. The governor has signed an executive order to protect Maryland businesses from sudden or substantial increases in the unemployment tax bracket as a way to help them stay in business. Okay. Governor Larry Hogan is letting us know that he is writing, so he's actually approving more funding going out to businesses across the state of Maryland. But he's not shutting down anything. Governor Hogan, early on in this fight against COVID-19, came out as a heavy hitter. We were one of the first states to close down. If you remember, it was on a Friday where he said, y'all need to get it together. By the following week, Dad said, look, I'm shutting all of this down. And he shut everything down. I believe that Governor Hogan's reaction was a response to the fact that our president, Donald Trump, wasn't doing anything. I just want you to think, come with me for a second. Donald Trump refused to step in with a heavy hand on behalf of America as a whole. And so that responsibility was pushed down to the governors. Governor Hogan, Governor Cuomo all came in and took very strong stances, closing down their cities, closing down their states with the hopes that they could save lives. I think when the pressure got to be too much, as we saw in Annapolis when they had the protest, open up our state. As we saw in Michigan, open up our state. You had people protesting across the South, open up our state, so we're going to starve. I believe a number of governors, Hogan included, took the pressure off themselves and pushed the pressure onto local officials. That's what I believe. I believe it was to take the pressure off him. That, hey, it's not me. I've passed that responsibility down to your mayor. Let Mayor Young decide what to do. Which I think is an interesting strategy because I don't understand how his strategy was any different than Donald Trump's strategy. Donald Trump said, not me. I'm going to let the governors do it. The governors did it, and then when it got too hot up in the kitchen, the governor said, not me, let the local officials do it. Pass it down to the mayors. So Mayor Young stepped in, and he was very cautious. Like, we got to give credit where credit was due. Mayor Jack Young was very cautious in how we move from one phase to the other, in terms of how we open things up. Well, things continue to open. I don't know if Mayor Young got tired. I don't know, Justine. I just think you got to the end. You're like, you know what? I'm done. Let the next mayor deal with this. Brandon Scott just got inaugurated, and brother came out swinging. Like, it's like they rang the bell. He came out swinging. What he has done is he has tightened up the restrictions. Not just tightened up. He's closed things down. Which is interesting because we got to figure out what this means for us. I want to know from you, what do you think about that? Jeffrey Van Brown on Facebook Live said, why isn't Governor Larry Hogan talking with his fellow GOP member, Senate Leader Mitch McConnell? The real reason nothing has been done at the federal level since March to help the people, the citizens of Maryland, as well as the rest of the nation. Hey, look at this. Mitch McConnell is one man who, in my opinion, needs to go. He has too much power. And unfortunately, unless we flip Georgia, Georgians, I hope you're listening, unless y'all get out there and vote, we got four more years of Mitch McConnell's America. You think Trump's America was bad? Trump's America only got pushed forward because Mitch McConnell was the wind in his sails. Mayor Brandon Scott tightened up the restrictions. He laid them out. They go into effect 5 p.m. So tomorrow, 5 p.m., they go into effect. So he has kept, in terms of capacity for retail and religious institutions, gyms, malls, and museums, 25% capacity. Restaurants, you're not doing any more indoor dining or outdoor dining. You have to go for your carryout. Your delivery. He said the hookah bars, that can wait. Brother actually said, look, The hookah bars can wait. Hookah, I don't know what they're doing up in the bars, but whatever you've been doing, you will not be able to continue with that because that has ended. In Baltimore, 366 people are hospitalized for COVID-19. 90 of them are in intensive care. On average, we are reporting 37 new cases per 100,000 people each day. The testing positivity rate is 7.3%. Now, I don't like to point out the obvious, Justina. But I'm going to go ahead and do it because we had Dr. DeRosa on our show on Friday. She came on after I talked to Fauci and I asked her, what is the positivity rate for Baltimore? If I am not mistaken, Justina, she said we're in the 5.5%. I was like, oh, that's great. Given that the threshold is 5%, we know you're in danger mode, but Maryland is at 8%. I was like, okay, if Baltimore City's at around 5.5%, okay, we're not doing spectacularly wonderful, but we're not as bad off as the state. Well, according to this article, no. Baltimore City's at 7.3%. So either we jumped up from Friday until today. And if we have jumped up like that, you should take a seat. I mean, I think if you're driving, you should pull over. Because what this actually means is there is a good chance that nobody is going to come out on the other side of this unscathed. That if you're able to go through the next year or so without getting COVID-19, I mean, it sounds like it'll be a miracle. I mean, like, it sounds like that will be a miracle if you can do that. Do you agree? Here we are, y'all. Only a couple of weeks from Christmas. I know. Christmas on the 25th. Only a couple of weeks from Kwanzaa. I know. Kwanzaa, I get it. We're only a couple of weeks away from the new year rolling in, and everything's been shut down. I just want to ask you whether or not you agree with this. Jeffrey also just helped correct me. Jeffrey, I don't know why you're going to make me cry. Actually, Mitch McConnell has 6 more years. So that means we're stuck for at least another 2 years. You don't understand. Mitch McConnell's America is a hard place to live. Give me a call. 410-319-8888. Today's the start of Hanukkah. Christmas is coming. Kwanzaa is coming. The New Year is coming. Everything's been shut down again. Do you agree with Mayor Brandon Scott's decision? Let's make a note. We can disagree with our mayor. It's okay. It doesn't mean we don't like Brandon Scott or we don't support Brandon Scott, but we actually can disagree with our mayor, and that is fine, okay? Like, everybody's okay disagreeing with Trump. Anybody black, we get upset. It's okay. I think Mayor Brandon Scott would be okay with us just kind of talking it out. We have Lene on the phone from Maryland. Lene, how are you?
Hello, Dr. K.
Hello.
I'm from Baltimore City, a proud Baltimore City native daughter.
I love that.
So, I 100% agree with Mayor Scott. I sympathize with our restaurant industry. However, this pandemic started in March, and we were 100% closed down from March to June. One of the hallmarks of and entrepreneurship is the ability to be nimble and to respond and be flexible. There has been time to retrain your staff, to reallocate your assets, to revisit your business model, to prepare. It is a pandemic. Pandemics don't go away in 3 months. You need to look at making meals for family. Look at making meals for these first responders and nurses that do not have time to cook. I bet you these meal kits aren't flying off the shelves and all these people signing up for HelloFresh and Hello Everybody wouldn't love to buy from these local restaurants instead. Get creative.
I like that. Well, let me ask you this, Lene. So, restaurants are closed for indoor and outdoor dining, but Walmart, Target, markets, casinos are still open.
Should
those places be closed too? Okay.
Eating and drinking can't be done with a mask.
Okay.
Okay. I can shop, gamble, and work out with a mask on.
Can't eat a drink.
I'm at home being a virtual learning extraordinaire teacher. I ain't going out and doing none of this stuff.
I know that's right.
I'm behind home. Also, if you think about how teachers have had to completely recreate their profession.
Yes, they have been.
So can restaurant owners.
All right. Thank you so much for your service, Lene. We have Lucille on the phone from Baltimore. Lucille, how are you?
Hi, Dr. K.
Thanks for calling.
Things need to be shut down. I have a relative who's in this group. It's a money-making group, whatever. To me, it's like a pyramid scheme. Anyway, they sign people up. If you get so many people below you, you raise up on the totem pole and you make more money. But it's a travel group. Now, the man who runs this whole thing, he's making money off of every time he has the group, all the people in this thing get together. They just came back from Mexico. Why are you going to Mexico during a pandemic? When I saw, now this is a relative of mine. I'm not going to say her name in case she's listening, but she'll be mad at me to get over it. When she posted on Facebook,
I saw
all these people in the pool. My cousin had her mask, but she was away from everybody, but she was talking. She didn't have her mask on. But when I saw everybody else in the water, no mask, no nothing.
Come on.
And I don't mean 5, 10, 15. It looked like a couple of hundred people to me. Now, when they came back by way of New York, you have to go through all this rigmarole even to get out the airport. They even had the National Guard there, which is good. So I asked my relative, so are you, she lives in D. She lives near D.C. Now, I said, are you staying up there for 10 days? He goes, no. I'm coming back. That was Sunday. No, it was Monday I was talking to her. She said, no, I'm coming back Tuesday.
So she's not doing any quarantining at all.
As far as her thing to me was, I get the COVID test now. It's one of the quickie ones. And then in 4 days, I get another one. So I just talked to her today, and she says, I've had a test every day since I've been back. I'm negative. But I still could have sworn I've heard over and over again, you're supposed to stay quarantined
for
10 days.
You are.
Isn't it 10 days?
You are. It's 10 days now if you have no symptoms.
Yep. You should be asymptomatic, right?
Yes, you're absolutely right. You are supposed to quarantine. That's where it is right now. If you have tested negative, you're still supposed to, if you've traveled. Thank you so much, Lucy. I'm going to hold you here. Folks, let me tell you, we're going to continue with this conversation because every day we've been bringing you information as we've kind of leaned into the science just to unpack it. We have talked with Fauci about the vaccine as a whole. We talked to an epidemiologist about how do you live now with COVID-19. Yesterday, we talked to an infectious disease specialist to talk about what's in the vaccine. When we come back from the break, I have an epidemiologist and medical doctor and researcher from Morgan State University. We're going to talk about herd immunity. Exactly. What is it? Why is it important? When will we know when we get there? We'll talk about all of that when we return. Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. I'm joined now by Dr. Foreign Kamagar, a university distinguished professor and assistant vice president for research at Morgan State University, right here in Baltimore, right here where I'm sitting at this moment, HBCU. Dr. Kamagar is a medical doctor and epidemiologist, received his PhD in epidemiology from Johns Hopkins University. He's authored over 200 peer-reviewed publications and has conducted research on treatment of COVID-19 patients. Dr. Kamagar, how are you, sir?
Hello. I'm fine. Thank you for having me in this program.
Yes, I'm excited to have you. We've been talking every day about COVID-19. We started with having Dr. Fauci, who gave us an overview on Friday of the vaccine. We had an epidemiologist from Hopkins on earlier this week who talked about how do you live with COVID-19 now in terms of going to the store and getting food. Yesterday, we had an infectious disease specialist on from the University of Maryland Medical System talking about exactly what's in the vaccine. And with you, which trying to get an answer to a question that a lot of our callers keep coming up with. Can you talk with us about herd immunity? Exactly what is it? We keep hearing that. We don't know what that means or what's going to happen once we get there.
So herd immunity is a concept in epidemiology that not everybody in the society has to be immune for the epidemic to stop. Only a certain percentage have to be immune. When we talk about COVID-19, that number is about 65% or two-thirds of the population. So when two-thirds of the population have developed antibodies either because they got the disease and now they are immune or got the vaccination, the epidemic will stop. So we are looking for that 65% of the population to be immune.
Okay, so let's break that down, because we know there are roughly, 327 million or so people in this country. So the idea is to be able to convince that many people, 65%, to take the vaccine. And if they do, does that mean that those who don't take the vaccine, that they'll be fine? They don't have to worry about getting COVID-19 if 65% of the people have been vaccinated or have developed an immune to it because they had COVID-19.
Assuming that two-thirds are evenly distributed among populations, the rest will most likely be immune, because if a lot of people around me are immune, then the chain of transmission will break.
Okay.
But if that is not evenly distributed, let's say in Baltimore nobody has the vaccine, okay, but let's say in Michigan everybody has the vaccine, that will not be the case, because there will be still a lot of people in Baltimore around me who are not immune, and the transmission chain will not be broken. So yes, if two-thirds of the people around me are immune, most people will be safe.
Now, if someone has had COVID-19, because I know they've been testing for the antibodies, have they found out yet? Have you found out yet whether if I've had COVID-19, I've healed from it, if that means that I'm fine going forward, that I won't get it again?
So COVID-19, as you know and your audience know, is a new disease. So we don't know everything about it. But so far we know that once somebody gets the disease, it's very unlikely that they will have the disease again within the next 6 months. We need to follow the patients for years to know how long that immunity will last, but they will be fine for at least 5-6 months. But, you know, the recommendation, though, is that because we don't know how long that immunity will last,
right,
even if you have got the disease a few months ago, it is still recommended that when available to you, please take the vaccine.
Okay, and so now this is where people are getting stuck. And then we've been trying to answer this, because we know from what the infectious disease specialist talked about, that this has not been used widely. No trial studies have been done for the under 12 population. So what would you recommend for children when we don't have data to say it's actually working or it doesn't work?
So that's a very good question. We haven't done trials in children because we usually, when we start clinical trials, we start with the healthier ones and those who need it more. And we usually leave women who might be pregnant and children for later stages. Given that the vaccine has acted very, really well, has been very successful in the population studies, I'm sure that the trials will roll out to children too. So in a few months, hopefully we will have the results for the children. In the meantime, children are not the first group to be vaccinated. The first group to be vaccinated are those who are health workers, or those who are older and at high risk of disease, or those who have severe comorbidities. For the first few months for vaccination, we are focusing on those who really need the vaccine most. In the meantime, by the time we get to children, hopefully we will have that data that how it works in children. My assumption and hypothesis is that it will work very well for children too. The good news is that children are at much, much, much lower risk of hospitalization and death compared to people who are at older ages.
Now, we've had COVID-19 for about 10 months in the United States. We know it was, you know, they really found it last year around this time in Wuhan, China. But we're at a point now where we have over 15 million people infected. Over 290,000 people have died. What lessons have we learned, if anything at all?
We have learned many lessons, you know, both about the disease, we know about the virus that it causes, the disease, we know about the genetic of the virus. We know that we now have at least three vaccines, the ones by Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca that are effective and safe. The Moderna and Pfizer vaccines have been 95% effective. 95% effective means if there is a group of people who don't get the vaccine, maybe 100 people among them get the disease. But the same number of people, if they have got the vaccine, only 5 of them get the disease. 5 versus 100. That is a huge, huge efficacy. We also know that those who have got the vaccine, none of them, fortunately, were hospitalized or died, which is a huge thing. Unfortunately, we have much less about therapeutics. For therapeutics, we know that it's only dexamethasone at this point that works, and that is only for people who need oxygen or are hospitalized,
okay,
not in earlier stages. We are looking for more therapeutics. We also have learned quite a bit about prevention, which is masks and sanitizers, and much more, but I will stop here.
Okay, well, then let me ask you, because I think that this is what concerns me. With all the lessons that we've learned, for you, as an epidemiologist, as someone who's kind of studying and looking at the treatment for COVID-19 patients, what went wrong? I mean, you would think with all the lessons, we should be better off right now than we were.
Well, unfortunately, what has happened is that we have not been able to entirely contain the disease, but with the public health measures that we have had. So the public health measure that we have had is just, distance, keeping distance, is using masks, and is using hand sanitizers. Yet when you have distance, that means closing down businesses, closing down schools, which has a economic impact. So sometimes people have gone to work despite all the recommendations. And sometimes people have had meetings, and unfortunately, there is a level of distrust to some health authorities. So sometimes people have been having meetings, social gatherings, not heeding the advice from public health experts, and some of those really led to huge outbursts of the disease. We did have the science, but not everybody heeded the science.
Now, if you look back at the 1918 flu pandemic, I mean, I've been going back and I've been trying to read that and study to try to figure out how did they get out of it, that there seemed to be wave after wave back in 1918. If you look then and to where we are now, were there specific lessons that we learned from that period of time that we've used to kind of help us during this outbreak?
Oh, absolutely. So in 1918 flu pandemic, which also kills millions of people, at the time they did not have any vaccines. So what happened is that people got out of the disease by really what you said at the beginning, herd immunity. Enough people got the disease that they either died, or there were enough people in the society who were immune and they did have immunity and they did get out of it. But unfortunately, at that time, many millions of people died. We are fortunate now that we now have a vaccine that will be rolled out within the next few months. So although we still have huge fatalities, it is nothing close to what happened to 1918 because of advancements of science. There are lessons from those times. If you go back, there are records from 1918 that they compared cities, that they heeded social distancing and closing down the businesses versus those who did not. And those cities that had more social distancing they had much lower rates of mortality. So social distancing, masks, sanitization still applied 100 years ago. They still apply today. But fortunately, we now able to have to prove that we have vaccines that are effective in 10 months. We haven't seen the effect yet. It will happen within the next few months.
Now, I have a hard question for you, Dr. Commager, and I really appreciate you. It's University Distinguished Professor, Assistant Vice President for Research here at Morgan State University. So we know for children to go to school, they have to be vaccinated. You got to have the MMR. You got to have all kind of shots that we have to make sure that our children have to send them into school. Do you think that the COVID vaccine, in order for us to get to that 65% for herd immunity, do you think that people should be forced to take it, where they have no choice but to do it so that we can get beyond this and kind of get on with our lives on the other side?
Well, I'm glad that you made it clear that it was a hard question, because it is a hard one. Sometimes it is, you know, and it is just beyond a medical expert to comment on that, because sometimes when you force something, there are negative reactions. People avoid it. But I would say, rather than, this is my own opinion, rather than forcing it on people, I believe we have to communicate very clearly how much these vaccines are vetted and how much science is going into them, so that people understand for themselves that whether to take it or not. I can tell you personally, I will take the vaccine. I will definitely have my children vaccinated when it is available to them. My wife, who is a physician, will take it. And you see that President Obama pledged that he will take the vaccine on TV. The reason is that they trust the system. For FDA to approve a vaccine, it, you know, let me just say this. The Moderna vaccine was made in 2 days. Over one weekend, and it was ready in January 13th. So why are we have not used it? Because it has taken 10 months, 11 months, for Moderna to do the animal study, to take it to a small group of humans, which is called phase one human studies, to be sure that it is safe, it's not causing a problem, to phase two studies to make sure that we are making antibodies against it, to phase three in tens of thousands of people to make sure that it doesn't cause any harm or major harm, and it is really 95% effective. So there is a lot of meticulous work going into it. And it is also transparent. As you and I are speaking, FDA advisory board is now reviewing the Pfizer vaccine, and they are broadcasting the entire deliberations on YouTube so that people can see for themselves. So I would prefer building trust with people rather than forcing them.
Dr. Commager, I want to tell you, this is the first time that I heard what you just said. I have never heard this before. We've talked about COVID-19 since January on this show. To know that it was done, finished in a weekend, it was ready by January 13th. Maybe people just knowing that might calm people down, because people have a feeling that they're just doing it. They're just completing it. They're rushing it through. No, it was already done in January. All they've been doing for 10 months is just rolling it out in stages and testing it.
That is exactly correct. FDA is very demanding and exacting. So for a company to show FDA that their vaccine is safe and effective, it takes a long time and millions of dollars. So they have been doing this step by step. And the reason that this time was, you know, much faster, it is not that they cut corners. It is that this time the federal government was basically paying the money in advance, that you go do it, I'm going to buy it from you. Money is not an issue. Right. So they didn't think, they were working day and night just to prove that it is scientifically good.
Now, I know that one of the things that they've been talking about is that here in America, because earlier with the administration that's currently in office said no to getting more vaccines, that we don't have enough coming in. We heard 100 million doses, and when that was translated, they said that's really like 50 million people.
Yes, we do not have enough at the moment. Although a couple of months ago they started making the vaccines, you know, each person needs about two shots. So if we have about 50 million right now, that is good for only 25 million people within the next month or so. And that will be mostly healthcare professionals and people in long-term care facilities. But companies are working very hard in enhancing their production capacity, in also distribution. And we are hopeful that by sometime like June, July, most people who want this vaccine would have got it. And they are really ramping up production, but we don't have enough for the U.S., let alone for the rest of the world. There are many third world countries who really need the vaccine, and they want a vaccine, and there are many institutions in the U.S. and across the world that are trying to get the vaccines to those who are really needed.
Now, I know I don't have much time with you. I just have a couple of more questions. Just I want to go in for a second about something you just said. You said it's going to take about two shots. What I'm trying to understand, Dr. Kammerger, is it going to be something like the flu vaccine where I have to get it every year? Or is it more like measles, mumps, rubella? Once you get it, you're fine. What do you think?
So we don't know that yet, Okay. Exactly. Because as I said, for flu, we have had it for a long time. We know quite a bit about it. This is a new vaccine. We are science develops, you know, little by little by working on this bits and pieces. But I have to say that the good news about this one is that it has far less mutation rates, meaning SARS-CoV-2, which causes COVID-19, has far less mutation rates than influenza. So influenza virus has a few parts, and those parts are like a puzzle. They just mix together, and sometimes they have lots of mutations. This one doesn't. I am hopeful that this one will not be every year, but even if it is, that is a small price to pay for a very important health matter.
Now, so for my last question, it's actually just a series of small questions, just rapid fire, just yes or no, because we want to know as epidemiologists how you are living with the vaccine. So do you eat out?
I do not eat out.
Are you taking your clothes off at the door? Because there was a whole thing, we don't wear the clothes from the outside into the house. Are you doing that? Would you recommend it?
I do not go with that, unfortunately. No, I still keep my clothes because usually I don't spend much time outside, and touching the surfaces is a much less important route of getting rather than actually from person to person.
How about mail and packages and groceries? Wipe them off, or we're fine with that now?
We're fine with that if we keep it for a couple hours, you know. And at most, the thing is that you just wash your hands after that. I wash my hands after touching mail that comes from outside, but I don't worry too much about it beyond that.
And then my last question for you. One of the questions I asked Dr. Fauci, and I've asked every doctor on this show, what was the moment for you when you knew this was going to be something big that would completely shift and change the way we live in this country and on this planet? What was that moment for you?
It was sometime, in late February or middle of February when papers came out of China that showed how much mortality there has been, which was close to 1% to 2%. That is huge. And we also knew by then that herd immunity will not happen unless we have 65% of the population. That really shocked me because I said, well, 65% of the United States, we're talking about 200 million.
Yes.
What if 1% of them died? That is two million deaths. That was a shocking moment for me. And I said, this is going to be bad. And I think today, our worst fears did not realize. It is still 300,000 people, which is terrible, and it may get to 500,000, but it was in millions, which I feared. I feared it will be millions of deaths, and I feared that we will not have vaccine for years, but now, fortunately, we have had vaccine for 10 months. So it is bad, but not our worst fears.
Well, Dr. Foreign Kammerger is a university distinguished professor, assistant vice president for research here at Morgan State University, a medical doctor and an epidemiologist. He has conducted research on treatment of COVID-19 patients. We appreciate you and we thank you for your time.
It was a pleasure speaking with you, Dr. K.
Absolutely. So, folks, we are working hard every day to try to give you a little bit more information. Let me tell you what we're not doing, because a lot of people have been asking me exactly what are you doing. Let me tell you what we're not doing. We are not telling you to take the vaccine. We're not saying that. We are not shaming people who won't take it. All we're trying to do is provide you with enough information so you can make an informed decision for your family. So now, if you're keeping track, we've now had two epidemiologists. We've had an infectious disease specialist. We've had Fauci. Like, we have gone, we had a pediatrician just call in yesterday. He's a pediatrician over at Hopkins, just to give us his opinion and add his voice as a Black man with young children to the conversation. I think we have tried to give a lot of information. I know that it's a big decision, and I know that it's hard to do. I want to make a correction. The doctor was from Mercy Medical Center. I know it's a big decision. Here's how you prepare yourself. You got to arm yourself with knowledge. We're going to open up the show, 410-319-8888. Everything is closing here in Baltimore or going down to 25% capacity as a way to keep you safe. We're at almost 300,000 deaths. They're saying that's not their worst fear. Their worst fear was millions of dead people in America due to COVID-19. 300,000, even though that's a lot, according to Dr. Comegar, that's not their, wasn't their worst fear. There's a vaccine that's been available since January 13th. I'm blown away. I've never heard that before. That all they've been doing is testing it. So it's not something that they just developed last week. It's now going to the final stages. I want to hear from you. 410-319-8888. Jessica's on the phone from Baltimore. Jessica, how are you?
Hello, Dr. K. I am doing well. Thank you.
Thank you for calling.
Yeah, so I'm calling just to chime in and, you know, give my opinion on some of the information that was giving out of what you were asking. But first, I want to say thank you for having that professor on here. He just clarified and cleared up so many misconceptions. I know, at least for myself, some misunderstandings. You know, you watch CNN and you see a lot of things happening all the time. But he just really brought it on home. And so I really appreciate. So thank you for giving us that information.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, so I am a Baltimore native. I'm born and bred in Baltimore. I'm an educator in Baltimore, and I educate populations, underserved populations of students. And so, and I also engage with the families of those students on a continuous basis for what I do on a daily basis. And so what I was saying about Mayor Scott, I appreciate and I understand his rationale and his reasoning for why he decided to do that. However, I know that in these times, we have to make abrupt decisions. We have to do things quickly. But I think that given that it's holiday time and that, you know, the folks weren't anticipating this to happen so quickly, that a shutdown could occur. You know, however, just given maybe an additional week so people can get themselves in order, get their finances together, and make some other choices so that the businesses that, you know, were following the guidance of the current administration, which was you could have outdoor dining, and they invested in tents and heaters and invested in all these things for their businesses, the small businesses, to later come back, you know, and say that they need to shut it down now. And so I think that before a decision is made, all of those pieces need to be taken right into consideration prior to doing it, and, you know, and give the, you know, people the choice. If people are choosing, you know, because we're not going to be able to stop the campaign no matter what you do. People are going to find a way to get together. But my biggest concern is about the families that I serve who work in these restaurants, who depend on these jobs, who are not going to be able to pay their bills at the end of the month, who are not going to be able to feed their children at the end of the month because of an abrupt right decision, I believe. That was made abruptly. You know, I know you have to come in. I know you have to get your footing. I understand that. But you need to look at the entire picture. You know, we, like I said, we're a week off from Christmas. And I know that a lot of people don't celebrate Christmas, but there are a lot that do.
Right.
And so they may have been planning on this next paycheck to be able to get something for my children. You know, it's been rough. It's been a hard time for our families. And so they may have needed this week to work to get their couple of dollars together to go buy their children something, to go buy their spouse something. And so just give people time. So you could have said, we're going to shut down as of December the 28th, you know, something along those lines, versus abruptly shutting. You know, I've seen multiple small businesses that I follow and try to support here in the Baltimore area that have posted they're closing, you know, please come in. They're trying to max out today on, you know, some of their events and things like that to get people in so that their staff can get some money. And I understand, you know, about big businesses and big corporations, but when we talk about Baltimore City, we don't have a lot of that going on when it comes to the small restaurants and the small families.
All right.
And, you know,
I got to stop you there, Jessica. I appreciate you. I'm so sorry. I got to get Crystal on. New call from Baltimore before we go to break. Crystal, how are you? Crystal, are you with us?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, go ahead.
Start from the beginning, or?
Oh, please, no, we just want you to add your comment to the conversation.
Okay, I just wanted to say that, you know, when it comes to getting a robust conversation, you really need to touch on why people are concerned. And specifically when it comes to vaccines and whether or not people, you know, trust them or anything like that, the adverse reactions are touted to be things like, you know, mild. You know, skin reaction, not feeling well, that sort of a thing. However, in reality, when someone actually has a loved one that has dealt with it, it's much more devastating. My son specifically had Gardasil 9, the HPV vaccine that was intended for teenagers, males and females, to prevent HPV. He, within seconds, had a seizure and scared the crap out of me.
Oh,
he never had a seizure in his life. And if you've ever been a parent and had to watch your child go through that, it's something you don't want to wish on your worst enemy. And it will absolutely make you fearful for the rest of your life. The doctors, when I asked for the paperwork, the information, you know, what was going on, what do we do now that he's had a seizure? Like, is it going to stop? Is there neurological damage in there? You know, what do I do now? Do I get a CAT scan? Like, what, you know, what now? They didn't have a protocol. Even though it was a pediatrician, there was no, you know, it's just go home, rest a little bit, and then we'll see you for the other half of the shot in a week.
Wow.
And I absolutely was not accepting that. That's not okay. Clearly, you know, it was literally like 3 seconds after he got that shot that he seized. So I was not about to give my son the second dose
of that. Makes sense.
I took my son to the emergency room because it didn't seem like the pediatrician was, you know, doing anything at all. And I had to argue with them as to report it to VIRS, because as a regular person, you don't understand that system. You hear that, anybody that's had an adverse reaction.
Crystal, I'm going to have you hold on. Do not hang up. We got to go. It's a heartbreak. But if you hold on, we can get the rest of this story right when we come back. Folks, today with Dr. K, stay with us. More on the other side.